this event, and especially to all the guest visitors who have taken their time out to come here and listen to our speaker. We are happy that you made your efforts, and it's indeed a very pleasant occasion for me, and I feel quite privileged to introduce you the speaker of this 11th Homi Bhabha public lecture. Professor Benny Shilo is currently the Hilda and Cecil Lewis Chair Professor in the Department of Molecular Genetics of the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel. He was born in Jerusalem in 1951, completed his BSc in biology and PhD in genetics at the Hebrew University in 1978. And then he went on to MIT, Cambridge, USA, where he did his postdoctoral study with Professor Robert Weinberg at the MIT. And then he joined Weizmann Institute and set up his laboratory to study the signaling, cell signaling in Drosophila. While working at the MIT, Benny demonstrated that the DNA sequences of the vertebrate proto-oncogenes, these are the genes which produce proteins, and when these proteins are defective, they cause cancer. So that's why they are called proto-oncogene. And he found for the first time that these proto-oncogenes are not only present in humans, they're also present in Drosophila, the fruit flies. And that was the beginning of our understanding that these proto-oncogenes must play, or could play, a very important role in general biology of an organism. And later on, proto-oncogenes were found to be highly conserved and found in all other organisms. And since then, Benny devoted most of his academic career utilizing the sophisticated genetics and the other techniques available in Drosophila to discover the mechanism of cellular signaling pathways and their role in normal development. And it turned out that many of these proto-oncogenes play a major role in the regular development of an organism. And one of these in particular is called EGF, the endodermal growth factor, which he has invested most of his career in studying the function of the EGF signaling in Drosophila. And it is important also to note that the defective EGF signaling can also cause breast cancer. So there is an intimate link between the development and the disease, and that has been the hallmark of Benny's work. His new passion now is to develop a quantitative basis for near-accurate patterning of embryos to understand, to generate an accurate model of how an embryo develops from a single cell, which is the fertilized egg. And this is going to be the topic of today's lecture. So at Weizmann Institute, he served as the head of the molecular genetics department, dean of biochemistry, and head of the Council of Professors. And he has a vast experience as an educator and in institution management. He has been a visiting professor at the Yale University and Stanford, and a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. He is a member of the European Molecular Biology Organization and served on its council for some time. He also served as the editorial, he's also currently in the editorial board of many prestigious research journals, such as the EMBO Journal and the Molecular Systems Biology. Professor Shilo is a long-term member of the Academic Management Board of National Center for Biological Sciences in Bangalore, which is a TIFR center. He has also served in the review committee of the Biological Science Department of TIFR, this campus of TIFR, and has been visiting India since 2002. And he comes here every 2 years to organize what is now very famous called Benny Shilo Course of Developmental Biology. It's organized at NCBS every alternate year. And this year, he is going to again organize the course right after this from next week onwards. Benny has many research achievements, and he won many prizes for his research achievements. Two of the most notable prizes are the Bruno Prize in 2000 and the EMET Prize in Genetics in 2013. Now, this EMET prize is given specifically to people who make strong contributions in both science and art. And that is also the other quality of Professor Shiloh. His long-term passion is photography. He is a professional art photographer, and you will get a glimpse of his artistic creativity in the talk very soon. In my opinion, he also has a very, you know, unusual ability to capture the subtle moods of people through his photographs. And I hope someday you come here again and show us those photographs, and those are equally exhilarating. In today's lecture, he will explain to you the art of embryo creation by combining metaphors of real-life observations and that of the experimental evidences we have already found. Although large part of this knowledge is already described in many textbooks and part of our college and higher level teachings, Benny's photographs and the discourse that he provides along with it makes them really special and very easy to understand. So without much further ado, I present to you Professor Benny Shiloh for today's talk. Thank you.
Can you hear me? So thank you for the kind introduction. It's really a pleasure to be back here at TIFR. And in general, this is really a passion for me to come and visit India every year. Since 2000, I've been visiting India almost every year, and it's a real pleasure. I'm just in love with this country and its people. And as Krishnu mentioned, we have next week the developmental biology course at NCBS, which takes place every 2 years. So the topic that we'll describe today is probably one of the most fascinating questions in biology. How does an embryo develop? And this is not only aesthetically beautiful, but it's also extremely intriguing from the scientific point of view, how the information to generate such a complex and reproducible structure, where is it stored and how is it executed and what do we actually know about it? And the whole process begins upon fertilization of the egg, the sperm. This is not the landing on Mars, but it's fertilization of the egg. And the DNA that is contributed by the nucleus of the sperm and the nucleus of the egg is essentially the genetic information that will be carried out by all cells in the developing embryo. So the information present within these two cells and in the combined nucleus that will be generated contains everything that is needed in order to make the embryo and to make pattern. So how is this information converted into pattern? Now we know that this information is genetic and it comes from the DNA, because if you look at identical twins, which are derived essentially from the same fertilized egg, contain exactly the same genetic information, they are very, very similar to each other. They are not identical. There are modifications that take place after the, or in addition to the DNA itself, but for the most part, they are extremely similar, indicating that this information that was embedded in the original fertilized egg can be transmitted faithfully and accurately, and this is something that we would like to understand. Now, in the last 30 years, there's really been a revolution in our scientific understanding of how embryonic development takes place, but somehow my feeling was that this revolution was not carried on to the general public, so I thought that it was important to convey this information, not only because it is interesting and exciting and relates to each one of us, but also because it carries with it a lot of medical implications that are currently used and will be used even more in the future in the clinic, and we should, the public should understand more about it. So how do you do that? How do you convey this scientific information? So we have these fantastic findings that have emerged in the last 20 or 30 years. It's important to educate the public, but the question was how to do that, and I'll try to show you a novel way that I try to develop of combining photography and using photography as a way to convey these scientific principles in a way which will be amenable to the general public. And the general idea is the following. When you look at a picture from our world, the saying is that a picture is worth 1,000 words, and the reason is that when you look at this picture, each one of you has his or her recollections and associations and thoughts of things you saw or read or whatever, and it triggers a whole set of emotions just by looking at this picture. And of course, it may evoke different emotions in different pictures, in different people. Now, on the other hand, in science in general and in biology and developmental biology in particular, we generate a lot of scientific images, and this in many cases is the tool that we analyze, and these images are many times really beautiful. And here is one example, an image of muscles of the fruit fly embryo. The images are beautiful, but to most people they mean nothing. I mean, as you see, the only one who is looking at the picture is the baby. The parents are completely oblivious to it. And it's not their fault. I mean, they're looking at it, they're seeing a bunch of nice colors, but they really don't know what it means because they don't have the background or the explanation to go along with it. So in that sense, one can say that a scientific picture is worthless without 1,000 words. And the question is how to combine these two aspects. And the idea is that if we try to find analogs or paradigms for biological concepts in interactions, in situations from the human world, by pairing these two images, this may enhance the public understanding of the possibly complex biological scenario, and this joining of the two images will generate some kind of a dialogue that will enhance the understanding and really promote a more serious discussion. So this is the topic that I tried to address 2 or 3 years ago when I did a fellowship at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard. And the idea was to sort of compress the concepts of developmental biology to several defined concepts and images, and then think of analogs or paradigms from the human world, photograph them, and present these images together and think about the similarities between the two situations. And as you'll see, the similarities are not necessarily visual similarities, but more conceptual similarities that force you to really think more deeply about the concepts. So this project started as a photographic project, and after the images were generated, it was displayed as an exhibit in several places in the world. But then, along with the photographs, I decided to actually write a text, a popular text, that will go along with the pictures. And this is a book which appeared just recently by Yale University Press. And I encourage you to look at this website, which contains freely available to the public sample chapters, all of the images, and so on. So it has a lot of information in it that one can explore. And it's also an interactive site, in the sense that I hope that in the future people will insert their own analogies to developmental concepts into this site and will generate a dialogue. So the idea of analogies between biological situations and the real world is not an original one. It actually started with Robert Hooke, who was an extremely prolific scientist, and among other things, he developed a microscope, and he used this microscope to look at biological specimens. And one of the first specimens he looked at was the bark of a cork oak tree. So he looked at this section, thin section from the bark of a cork oak tree, and he saw these compartments, and he said, these look like cells of monks, so we will call them cells. So actually the first time that the word cell, these are of course, now we know, are the boundaries of cells in the bark of the cork, of the cork oak tree. So the first time that the word cell was used in a biological context was actually as an analogy to the human world. And what I'd like to do in this project is to have the viewer, or the listener in your case, feel like a cell in a developing organism, because in many ways it's similar. As you'll see, cells in the organism talk to each other, they interact according to a set of rules, so it's very similar to a human society, and therefore, I mean, I hope that the viewer can feel like a cell in an organism, and in this way make the concepts much more transparent and easy to understand. So the first question you may ask yourself: if all the cells in the organism receive exactly the same genetic information, how come some cells develop like bone and other cells develop like muscle? Why are the cells different from each other if they contain exactly the same genetic information? And the answer is that just like a filing cabinet where you can use different parts of the cabinet for different purposes, the different cards in the library for different projects, the cells don't utilize all of their genetic information at the same time. So the genetic information is the repertoire of all genes and proteins that the cell has, but every cell type will express a different set of proteins depending upon its function. So this is an electron micrograph of a muscle cell. So a muscle cell will express a particular set of proteins that are required for muscle function. Nerve cells will express other sets that are required for nerve function. So it's essentially the choice of what you decide to express which determines what kind of cell you are and what functions you will carry out. But in a way, this is already this is the final stage. I'm showing you here a fully developed muscle cell which develops which expresses certain kinds of proteins. But what we really want to understand is how do you generate the complexity of the organism. Here is we are looking at the hand of a developing mouse embryo, and you can see the muscles in red, the nerves in blue, and the tendons in green. So how are the different cell types coordinated with each other? Not just how you get to the final fate, but how do you coordinate things between different cells, and how do you start from a population of cells that are initially identical to each other and end up with such a highly orchestrated structure, which is so precise and so reproducible. Now, perhaps the most decisive experiment in developmental biology, which really determined the way that we think about the problems today, was carried out by Hans Spemann and Hilde Mangold in 1924, and he received the Nobel Prize for it in the early 30s. And the experiment that he did was the following. He took embryos of a developing frog, and at the very early stage of development of these embryos, there is a little fold that can be identified, and this is the place where the future head will develop. So he took cells from such a fold in one embryo and transplanted them in the flank of another embryo. And he used, as you can see, the donor was non-pigmented, the recipient was pigmented, so it was possible to identify which parts came from the donor and which parts came from the recipient. And the surprise that they got was that in several cases, they obtained this kind of embryo instead of the typical embryo. And essentially what happened here was that in addition to the normal head, we have a perfect duplication of a second head structure. You may say this is not surprising. You took the cells that will give the head and they developed into a head. But the surprise was that most of the cells that gave rise to this perfect second head actually originate from the recipient embryo. They are pigmented. So this means that cells that would normally give rise to the flank of... By the end of the lecture, I'll learn how to operate this, I hope. So cells that would normally give rise to the flank of the embryo, because of the fact that they encounter new neighbors, have now changed their program and did it in a very precise and dramatic way to generate a second head. So this essentially coined the term induction, meaning that the cells are talking to each other and these cells are inducing their neighbors to become something else. And what it indicated was that when we look at an early embryo, each cell doesn't know a priori what it will become. The cells have a multitude of choices, and it is essentially the interaction between the cells and the ability to follow certain rules that we'll discuss in a minute, which determines what the final outcome would be. So in a way, I mean, you can think about embryonic development not as a preset program for every cell, but rather as an accumulation of many, many decision points that the cells have to take. And in order to understand development, what we have to understand is what governs the choices in each one of these decision points and how cells can communicate with their neighbors in order to make the right decision at each junction. Of course, looking at this, one cannot help but think of the beautiful poem of Robert Frost about diverging roads. Now, I want to show you a movie which recapitulates the Spemann experiment just to show you how crude the initial manipulation is and how precise the structure of the second head that is formed looks like. So here's Hans Spemann and Hilde Mangold, and Eddie De Robertis is reproducing their experiment. So you take the cells near the fold from the future head of one embryo, and you will note how crude, you don't want this guy to operate on your brain. It's a very crude manipulation, and yet the system will work, as you will see. So you take a few cells and put them on the flank of the recipient embryo. A little push wouldn't hurt. The cells intercalate, and about 36 hours later, you get this amazing result. Two heads instead of one, and extremely precise duplication in spite of this very, very crude surgical manipulation. So what's going on here? How are the cells communicating to each other? Which molecules are participating? So this dramatic experiment, which was done in 1924, was followed by 50 years of complete frustration. People tried to isolate the elusive factors by which the cells are talking to each other here, and it was complete failure because these factors, these proteins, are present in very small amounts. The biological assay is very complicated. You simply cannot do it. And the solution came from a totally different direction and from a different organism, namely the fruit fly. So the fruit fly has been a model organism for over 100 years. The first mutation was isolated in 1908, an eye color mutation called white, in the lab of T.H. Morgan in Columbia. And it's a fantastic organism to study variety of features, essentially many, many questions in biology, for the following reasons. One, and that's perhaps the most important aspect for a genetic system, is that the life cycle is short. It takes only 10 days or sometimes 12 days from the time that the female lays the fertilized egg. The egg goes through embryogenesis and larval instars and pupa until an adult male and female emerge and are capable of generating the next generation. So it's a very short life cycle. Every female can lay up to 200 eggs, so you can get many progeny. The embryos develop outside the body of the mother, so it's easy to collect them, to synchronize them, and to study them, as you will see. And the other aspect is that so many people have been studying this organism for 100 years that a fantastic toolkit of tools, both genetic and molecular, has been developed for this organism. Now, in the late 70s, there were two scientists, Eric Vishaus and Jani Nusslein, and they came up with a very ambitious project of using genetics in order to try and figure out what people couldn't do after the Spemann experiment, to figure out how the embryo develops and what are the genes and proteins that play a role in this process. And they've used genetics, and I want to highlight what the essence of genetics is. The idea is that you have a certain process. You don't know how the process takes place. you're completely ignorant. It's a complicated process like embryonic development. You don't know how the process is executed, but you know obviously that genes are involved in the process. They make proteins that are important for it. So you knock out genes, you inactivate genes in a random manner, one after the other. The fruit fly has 13,000 genes, so you have like a library of mutations. Each element in the library is deficient in one of the genes, and you essentially ask yourself, which genes do I have to hit or to inactivate in order to disrupt the process that I'm interested in? In their case, it was embryonic development. So, I mean, trying to portray in an image what genetics is like, I mean, in a single image to portray what the method that you've been using during your entire scientific career and many other people, I thought of the following analogy. Essentially, genetics can be defined as the presence of the absence. When you inactivate a gene, you see what goes wrong, and from the defect that you identify, you infer what is the normal function of that gene when it is present. This is, in essence, what genetics is. So this is an imprint of leaves in Hampi, in the nice guest house in Hampi. The leaves are no longer there, but their imprint, their absence, is very, very evident. So what did Janni Nusta and Eric Vishaus find? And they received the Nobel Prize in 1995 for their work. So the fruit fly embryo, it takes 24 hours to develop. Towards the end of its embryonic development, the outer cells of the fruit fly, the skin, if you will, secrete a hard cutaneous layer, which is a layer which is called the cuticle. And this layer, which you're seeing over here, has a structure. And its structure actually reflects the structure or the fate of the cells that secreted it. So we can identify head structures and tail structures. You can see segments. So there are many, many elements of structure here that you see in this exogenous skeleton that the embryo lays. So suppose that we hit a gene which is essential for determining a very critical aspect of development, let's say how you form the head. So what you will get is a cuticle which is missing the head because the cells that were supposed to form the head did not develop properly. So this is what they were looking for. Embryos that are dead, but not just dead in an uninteresting way, but dead in a way which reflects the fact that the pattern of development was somehow disrupted. And the nice thing about this approach is, first of all, not that it is completely unbiased. You just look at the process without any preconceived notions. And the other is that there are 13,000 genes in the fruit fly genome. So if you look at the event repeatedly and they've looked at 18,000 mutants, you're likely to hit most of the genes that are responsible for the process that you're studying. So they did this work, and the results were astounding. And they were astounding for several reasons. The first was that even though the pattern of a fruit fly embryo is very complex, there are 50,000 cells, and there are all the tissues there, and nerve cells, muscle cells, and so on, even though the pattern is extremely complex, there were essentially only 200 genes from the a genome of 13,000 genes that are responsible for generating the pattern. So an extremely small number. The other surprise was that, in effect, if you look, there were several distinct genes, and when you inactivate them, they give rise exactly to the same defect, suggesting that they're operating in the same manner, in the same place, and so on. So it's even less than 200. We're talking essentially about 5 or 6 general defects that were identified. And the third surprise was that when the genes were eventually isolated molecularly, and Krishnu mentioned, I mean, one way of isolating them, that I approached it by starting from the human genes going to the fly. In this case, they went in the opposite direction. They isolated the mutants in the fly and then found out what these genes are and what they're doing. But the two approaches converged, and the finding was that all of these genes are conserved in their structure in all multicellular organisms. So essentially, the first primitive multicellular organism that emerged over 600 million years ago contained all of these genes and all of these pathways, and we are essentially not looking at a peculiarity of the fruit fly, but at the universal blueprint of multicellularity in all organisms. And this is extremely exciting, and it also changed the face of biology in the sense that everything that we study now is much more universal than we previously anticipated. So you may be studying the eye of the fruit fly, but you're actually looking at genes that cause cancer in humans and so on. Everything is much more universal than previously anticipated. And what these genes identified was essentially these elements that participate in the crosstalk between cells that Spemann postulated. So for cells to talk to each other, if one cell wants to transmit the signal, it generates a protein, a ligand, or a hormone, if you will, which is either displayed on its surface or secreted to the neighboring cells. The neighboring cells express on their membrane proteins that we call receptors. So these proteins are sitting there on the membrane, and once they encounter the ligand, they change their conformation, they're activated, and they trigger a whole suite of proteins that eventually transmits the information into the nucleus. Because as I mentioned in the beginning, in order for cells to affect each other, in order for changes to be stabilized, you eventually have to impinge on the program in the nucleus, which will determine which genes will be expressed and which genes will not be expressed. So this is a typical signaling pathway between cells, and the reason that different mutations gave rise to the same defects is that you can block the pathway at different places. You can make a mutation in the ligand, in the receptor, in the nuclear factor. All of these will give rise to the same defect because they're operating in a linear pathway. So this is the communication that cells use in order to talk to each other. And the surprise was that there are actually only 5 or 6 communication pathways between cells that operate during development. So the cells are talking only 5 languages. Each one of these languages is essentially comprised of a single word, if you will. And this communication has to essentially determine all the aspects of embryonic pattern, which is extremely complex. Now, not surprisingly, so these are just the names of these different pathways, but they essentially operate in similar ways. Now, not surprisingly, because these pathways play such a major role, there are many diseases, including cancer, that are connected to changes in components of this pathway. For example, if this receptor will be activated all the time, even without encountering its ligand, this can result in uncontrolled proliferation of these cells. So one can think about this biochemical crosstalk between cells that are there transferring information, they're transferring a substance from one cell to the other, and this transmits the information. So it's like a playback theater. This is an improvisation theater where people are passing an imaginary object between one another. The object can change size and shape as it is being transferred, and in this way the information is being transferred. So in essence, so we know now what the signaling pathways are, and what I want to show you now is that if the cells can communicate, and if there are basic rules that the cells follow, you can generate pattern. So think about this flock of starlings that are migrating in the sky. I'll show you the beautiful patterns that they generate. Now, these patterns may not be completely precise, they may not be completely reproducible, but in essence, in order to maintain such a cluster of birds while they're moving, the birds have to communicate with each other, they have to be aware of where their neighbors are, and they have to follow certain rules in order to maintain this structure. So this is what we're looking for. We found the communication, we're now looking for the rules. So let's look at an example for a simple rule. If we want to generate a nervous system on the skin of the fruit fly, we want to generate neural cells, which are shown here in red. These are relay cells that are separated from each other by distances that are more or less fixed. But we start from a population of cells that are completely identical to each other. There is no conductor here. No one will say which cell will develop where. So somehow the system has to organize itself by following a rule, but without a conductor. And the rule that the cells follow is the following. So let's start here from this model of cells that are identical to each other, and we want to generate this pattern within this field of cells. So there's a natural variability or fluctuation in the amount of hormone that these cells produce. So when the level of the hormone will reach above a certain level, that will be enough in order to make that cell into a neuronal cell, but in parallel, this cell will tell its neighbors, I'm a neuron, and therefore you will not be a neuron. And this simple rule, if operated correctly over time, will generate more or less the pattern that I showed you earlier. So, I mean, here is the simulation of how it will happen. So one cell becomes a neuron, becomes red. It tells its neighbors not to become neurons, so they become green. Then another cell does the same thing, and so on and so forth. So if the parameters are right, by the time the process is completed, you will have a more or less a dispersed distribution of these the neuronal cells. And let me show you how this works in the real... the idea is that these cells are separated from each other by a certain distance in a way similar to umbrellas on the shore where people are separated from each other. Let me show you how this works in real life. So this is, one can follow this process in live pupa, and we'll see here the green cells are the non-neuronal cells, and you'll see as the cells divide and so on, there are the red cells that are popping up. These are the neuronal cells, and they will generate a nice spacing between them. So here they are, you see, and additional cells will pop up, and the point is that the immediate neighbors cannot generate this same cell fate. So in the end, you end up with a nice lattice of distribution of neuronal cells that are separated by non-neuronal cells. It's not perfect, but it's an arrangement which is good enough, and it was carried out by following a single rule and a single communication pathway. Now, what happens when it goes wrong? So I told you that the essence of genetics is to figure out a process by seeing what goes wrong, or when it goes wrong. So suppose the cells will become deaf to each other, and we can make them deaf by removing the receptor that is responsible for receiving the signals from the neighbors. So they can talk to their neighbors, but they cannot hear what their neighbors are saying to them. And we've made a cluster of these cells here in the center that are deaf, that do not contain the receptor. They're oblivious to their neighbors. And what will happen is that while in the normal cell, spacing of the neuronal cells, these cells, they all have the capacity to become neuronal cells. They don't care what their neighbors are because they can't hear their neighbors, and therefore they all become neuronal cells eventually. So this experiment tells you that every cell has the capacity to become a neuronal cell, and it's the interactions with the neighbors which restrict that capacity in the right situations. So the analogy that if you recall the umbrellas which are nicely separated on the beach in Greece, in contrast, on the beach in Israel, it looks more like this mutant patch where every umbrella is on top of the other umbrella and there are no distances between them. Okay, so the question in a way is reversed. I mean, so I told you that the entire process of development, which is extremely complex, is carried out by only 5 communication pathways. So if there are only 5 pathways, how do you generate these elaborate structures? So in a way, the question is reversed. I mean, how do such simple modules generate such a complex structure in the end? And I'll give you some pointers as to how the system actually does it. So here is one way in which you would not like to do it. You don't want to make all the decisions at once. This is very confusing. It's a square, Davis Square in Cambridge, in Boston, and you enter and you're faced with 6 alternatives and you have to decide where to go. This is not good because you can get confused and you'll have troubles. So the way in which most developmental decisions are carried out are more like this game of dominoes, where at each phase you make a fairly simple decision, many times just a binary decision. But the decisions build on top of each other. So you start with one cube, and then you put another one, and another one, and another one. And by the end of the game, you'll have a fairly elaborate structure that was generated from the compilation of simple decisions that accumulated one over the other over time. And in the case of the fruit fly embryo, we can see this. So we start, the first asymmetry is a very rough gradient that you see here in blue. And this leads to the first wave of gene expression, which subdivides the embryo into 3 domains. And then these domains talk to each other and subdivide the embryo into 7 domains, and so on and so forth. So the decisions are simple, but they build on each other to generate the final complex structure. But inherent in this hierarchical decision is that the first decisions are more important than the last decisions, because they will determine everything, right? And we can see that here. I mean, who knows what this is? What? You can identify it? Right. So there's not much difference between them, right? I mean, the essential features were already presented here in this very rough combination of Lego blocks. The rest was just putting in more and more details. So the first decisions are the critical ones. And in essence, this is the secret of the Spemann experiment. I mean, what was transferred to the embryo was just the very rough instruction of where to make the head. Everything else followed according to the normal pathway, and therefore this second head was so precise. Another aspect is that while you have 5 different signaling pathways, you can actually combine more than one pathway in order to elicit a particular response. So you can have 2 pathways converging, and only when they will converge you'll get an outcome, or one pathway inhibiting the other, many, many different combinations, which provide a lot of combinatorics and a lot of possibilities. So in a way, this is like the palette of an artist, which can start with the 5 basic colors, mix them in many, many different ways, and generate an enormous amount of combinations. And here we see in the embryo again 2 different pathways that are activated. One is in blue, the other is in red. And in the place where these 2 pathways converge, a new cell type will be generated, in this case a particular set of muscles. Now, the signaling pathways, there are only 5 of them, and obviously there are more than 5 decisions that an embryo has to make throughout its development. It has to make thousands of decisions. So how do you make all these decisions with only 5 pathways? And the answer is that each one of these pathways is, you can think of it more like an electric current that you can connect to different devices. So one time it will emit light, another time it will activate a record player or whatever. So it's the context in which you activate the cell which will determine what the final outcome will be. So the pathways are in a way more like switches, and the context in which they're activated, which is changing all the time. The cells are changing, they're expressing new genes, new proteins, so they interpret the same signal in different ways, and you can achieve diversity in this manner. And the analogy that I had here was a street in Somerville in Boston, where there were many, many different immigrants. I mean, there was a Portuguese bakery and an Italian restaurant and a Hispanic barber and so on. And they're all looking out at the same street, but everyone sees something different based upon where they came from, what is their heritage, and so on. So your history affects the way in which you interpret an incoming signal, and therefore the same signal can elicit different responses in different tissues. And finally, in order to generate complexity, we know that our body contains parts that are different in the different segments. For example, look at the vertebra of this whale, and you can see that the vertebrae in this region are different from the vertebrae in that region. But in essence, the body is comprised of repeated modular units. These are the vertebrae in vertebrates or segments in invertebrates. And the course of development evolves in such a way that first you generate identical repeated units, and only in the last stage you impose subtle modifications on each one of them, which will correspond to the position in the body. So these vertebrae have slightly larger spines here, and these are slightly wider there, but these are modifications that were introduced only in the last stage. So you don't have to invent everything anew. You have a modular unit, and in the end, you modify it in a subtle way according to its position in the body. And in a way, I mean, the analogy I have here is the porches in a hotel in Tel Aviv. Every porch has two chairs, but you can see that you can organize the same chairs in different ways and obtain variability from the same modular unit. And for India, I mean, this is a nice example to show, right? Okay, now we mentioned communication between cells, and one type of communication is between cells that are immediately touching each other, and this is in cases where the hormone is either associated with a membrane of the cell that sends the signal or diffuses over a very short distance. But in many cases, there is a situation where cells can actually communicate with each other over long distances. And this involves the activity of proteins which are termed morphogens. Actually, the term morphogen was coined by Alan Turing, who also did very interesting theoretical simulations on morphogenesis. And the idea is the following. The protein is a secreted protein. It's produced by a small group of cells. This is the white protein that you see here. This is the layer of cells that will give rise to the wing of the fruit fly. So the protein is produced by a small group of cells. Obviously, it's present in very high levels in the cells that make it, and then it diffuses to the neighboring cells. And in the course of its diffusion, it will be degraded, it will be diluted. So the further you are from the source, the less you will see of this protein. And the cells have the capacity not only to determine whether they see or they don't see the protein, but they can also tell how much of the protein they've seen. So cells that will see a lot of the protein may develop into one type of tissue. Cells that will see less of the protein will develop into another type of tissue. So in this case, I mean, I told you that this is a language with a single word. It's a single word, but this word can have a strong volume or a low volume, and the volume makes a difference as to the outcome. So in a way, I mean, it's like this museum guide who is talking to these students, and the ones that are closer will hear her better, the ones that are further will hear her less loudly, but this information from a single source will be conveyed to a large volume, over a large volume. Now, there's a problem here in what I told you, in that on the one hand, I told you that these signaling pathways are conserved in all multicellular organisms. So the proteins that they make have not been altered over the last 600 million years. And I mean, the reason is that when they were altered, they give rise to lethality of that organism. So they have to preserve their original structure. On the other hand, we know that patterns can develop very, very rapidly. And one of the things that Darwin saw when he toured the Galapagos Islands was that in islands which developed, which emerged out of the sea only 600,000 years ago, there are new species that were developed on that island in a matter of sometimes thousands of years, even relatively short periods of time. So how do you reconcile these two aspects? On the one hand, that the major signaling pathways that dictate development cannot be altered, but on the other hand, that you can generate an enormous diversity of forms and structures and do it in a relatively rapid manner. So think about this saxophone player. The player and the saxophone, they cannot be changed. They are fixed, right? I mean, this is a fixed entity. But on the other hand, you can change the notes, and just by changing the notes, this same hardware and the same player can generate an infinite variety of tunes. And in essence, this is what happens during a development of pattern. So if you think about a gene in the genome, in our genome, every gene has essentially two parts. One part is the part that will code for the protein and will contain the information on the protein that you have to make. This part cannot be changed for these signaling pathways because they're talking to each other and you just have to preserve the hardware of this pathway. On the other hand, every gene also contains what we call a regulatory element, which determines when and where it will be expressed, how much RNA do you make, when do you make it, and so on. And it turns out that these are the regions which are susceptible to mutations that will give rise to alterations in pattern. So if we look at the pigmentation in the wings of these different fly species that have evolved over the last 60 million years, you see an enormous diversity in pigmentation pattern, but on the other hand, the genes that generate these pigments are exactly the same genes. They have not been altered during this time course of evolution. So what was altered was the instruction on where and when to express them, and this is enough in order to give this amazing diversity of structures and forms. So we talked about the ways that cells communicate with each other, and this communication involves the instructions for each cell on what to become a nerve cell or not to become a nerve cell and so on. But once these instructions have been finalized, you actually have to execute them in the end. So it's like buying a flight ticket on the one hand and boarding the plane on the other. There are two different entities. I mean, of course, you can't board the plane without the ticket, but just buying the ticket is not enough in order to get you to your destination. So there are many elements that go now into actually executing the instructions once the instructions have been given to the cell. And I'll just give you a few brief examples. So one of them is that in order to generate patterns, sometimes some cells have to die while other cells will persist. And this is in fact the way in which our digits are generated. The cells in between the digits are dying, and you can see it here in this 13-day-old mouse embryo. The red spots indicate organelles in the cell that are responsible for essentially eating away the cells that are positioned here such that you will generate the fingers. And the analogy is this person from Rajasthan who is carving the stone and generating pattern not by adding things but actually by removing structures in a regulated way. Cells migrate a lot in the developing embryo. They can be generated in one place and migrate to another place in the embryo, and their migration route is critical in order to determine the organ that they will form. So in a way, it's like a shepherd which is leading a flock of sheep, and the sheep follow him, and in the same way, these cells in the fruit fly embryo that will generate the tubes that will transmit air to the different tissues, these cells are generated in clusters and are migrating in a very stereotyped manner in order to generate this very intricate structure. And in the end, I mean, every embryo that is formed is really a miracle because the cells talk to each other, they communicate, it's not a very precise process, but yet the final outcome is extremely precise. I mean, look at these six different wing hinges of the six different flies, you can't tell them apart. They're essentially identical despite the complexity of the structure that was generated. And this is surprising or wonderful because the embryo is not like a mold that you fill, and therefore it's not surprising that every time the cast will be identical. You can think of an embryo, of making embryos, like this ceramic artist that is making balls. So it's a new process each time, and you have to be very accurate and precise in order to generate a collection of balls that will be sufficiently similar and reproducible. So we talked about the basic principles of development, and the question is whether these aspects can actually be harnessed for a human health. Can we actually generate body parts from our own cells with the knowledge that we've acquired about how an embryo normally develops? And we come to the issue of stem cells. You've probably heard the term many, many times, but I'm not sure whether people really have an accurate perception of what stem cells are. So the idea is that development of structures does not finish during embryogenesis. In fact, we are generating and differentiating new cells in our body all the time. Every day, we are generating 250 grams of cells that will line the inner parts of our intestine. Hair cells, skin cells, blood cells. Lots of cells are being generated again and again throughout the course of our lifetime. Now, of course, we can't carry around the progenitors of these cells with us in their undifferentiated state throughout our lifetime because it's just too many cells. You can make the calculation. Just for our intestine, 250 grams of cells a day, and that's quite a lot of cells to carry. So the solution is that of stem cells. So what are stem cells? A stem cell is a non-differentiated cell that is continuously dividing. And once it divides, the two products that it generates are different from each other. One of them will be identical to the original non-differentiated stem cell, while the other one will differentiate and generate the mature cells that are required in the tissue where that stem cell resides. So it can be skin or blood or whatever that tissue will require. So it's a very tight rope to regulate, because suppose that this division is not very accurate. If you make too many stem cells, if both progeny will be stem cells, then you'll end up with a tumor. If both progeny will differentiate, you will deplete your stem cells. So you have to keep this balance in a very accurate manner. And the way that is chosen in most cases to keep this intricate balance is to generate what is termed a niche for the stem cells. In other words, it's a geographically restricted location where only within that compartment the cells that divide can maintain their stem cell properties. So in other words, I mean, suppose that once this cell divided into two cells, only one cell had a place in the niche and the other one was kicked away, then this cell will maintain its properties, this one will differentiate, and the regulation will be fairly tight because the niche is a geographically restricted location, so it has a fixed size. When I thought about how to display this concept, my first inclination, but it never materialized, was to, I mean, I know that there are farms in India where only the first son inherits the land and the others have to go away because you don't want to split the land again and again. So sort of to collect this family and show the son who inherited and the others who became taxi drivers, lawyers, or what have you, but never got to that. So there's another analogy, so you'll see. So this is the niche in the eye of a developing zebrafish. So here is the lens, and the area around the lens is the area where the stem cells reside and where they maintain their properties. And once the stem cell divides, one progeny will remain while the other one will be kicked out. And as it's kicked out, it will differentiate into these neuronal cells. So the analogy to stem cells that I came up with was a bakery where you keep the your yeast culture, what they call the mother, and you continuously nourish it and feed it and propagate it and so on. And there are such mixes that are propagated for years by very famous bakeries. So you have to propagate it and maintain it, but on the other hand, you always take out some of it in order to make the bread, but once you make the bread, this is a dead end. I mean, you've lost your culture. So this fine balance of using your mother solution but maintaining it is essentially what stem cells are about. Let's skip this. And So in the future, we are likely to see more and more utilization of stem cells for regeneration of organs. And the important thing is that we want to generate the spare parts from our own body so that we won't encounter immunological rejection when we transplant them back into our body. And in a sense, this is already fairly heavily used in the case of the blood system. You can take cells from the peripheral blood, drive them back to their non-differentiated state, and then allow them to repopulate the bone marrow and generate stem cells that will regenerate your blood system. So for tissues where we know the players and where the tissue is operating in a solution and not in a very complicated three-dimensional organization, this is possible. It's beginning to be possible for other tissues, and I'm sure in the future we'll see more and more of that. But of course, we have to know the very fine details of how to tweak the cells and how to induce them to differentiate in the direction that we want and how to prevent them from making tumors and so on. And this just shows the challenge. You know that our body makes insulin and the pancreas contains thousands of these clusters of cells called islands of Langerhans. And within these clusters, there are many cells here that are called beta cells that secrete the insulin. You can see the insulin as these little white spots on the cells that secrete them. So if we want to cure type 1 diabetes in people who have lost these islands of Langerhans, we have to be able to reconstitute these structures from their own cells in order to cure them. So as you can see, this is not a trivial undertaking. It's a very complicated three-dimensional structure. There are different cell types here. It's a very complicated process, but the hope is that one day, or pretty soon, I think there are already initial reports that it can be done, we'll be able to actually carry out these very complicated issues. So just to summarize, the major take-home lessons that I want to leave you with is that the cell fates in embryonic development are not predetermined. The cells can assume a variety of fates, and it is the interaction between cells and the ability to follow rules that are embedded in the DNA which gives rise to the final intricate and elaborate structures. These cell communications are cell communication channels are universal, so the cells of all multicellular organisms are speaking exactly the same languages, and therefore we can study this process in a variety of organisms, and in all cases it's the same genes, the same principles, and the same concepts. These patterns are very precise for any given species, but they can evolve very rapidly when new species are generated by changing not the proteins that constitute these communication pathways, but the ways in which they are regulated, and subtle alterations. It doesn't have to be the dramatic Spemann experiment, but a subtle alteration in a place and time when a critical gene is expressed can generate a very significant diversity in pattern. And finally, all of these concepts apply to stem cells, which are undifferentiated cells that sit in different places in our body and generate a continuous supply of differentiated cells. And the hope is that when we understand the rules and when we identify these stem cells, we'll be able to generate spare parts from our own cells, and in this way, of course, cure many, many diseases that people are currently encountering. So just in conclusion, I want to thank the Radcliffe Institute and the Sloan Foundation for offering me the time and possibility to carry out this project, my lab and many colleagues for contributing many scientific images that I showed you today, and my wife for continuous support and advice and criticism throughout the process, and you for your attention, and I'll be happy to take questions. Yes.
Is it on?
The green light is on, so.
Is it on? No, my question was, what do the recent advances in induced pluripotency in stem cells have to effect on your work?
Okay. So, I saw that you saw the two slides that I skipped. So, one problem with stem cells is that their numbers are limited and we don't always identify them. And one of the big breakthroughs that took place in 2007 and received the Nobel Prize 2 or 3 years ago was the ability to take differentiated cells, cells from the skin, drive them back to their non-differentiated state. This is what is called induced pluripotent stem cell. And once that is carried out, there is essentially an unlimited supply of non-differentiated cells that can be used in order to make any tissue that you want. So in this, the importance of this operation is that stem cells are in a way no longer limited because you can generate them from other differentiated cell populations. So this, of course, has an enormous implication medically. It has still many risks because you're taking the cells back, but have you really converted them to the naive state and they've already undergone many divisions? Are their chromosomes sufficiently long in order to sustain more and more divisions? So there are many issues with respect to the question of how normal are these induced pluripotent stem cells, but they seem to be pretty good because you can generate a whole new mouse from a single cell that was taken from a differentiated blood cell, for example. So in that sense, the medical implications are enormous. The scientific implications are that, and many people are indeed studying that, I mean, beyond the actual practical utilization, that by studying how we can take cells back from their non-differentiated state to their non-differentiated state, we may be able to understand what goes on in the other direction. What do you have to erase in order to make them naive? Which elements are involved in this erasure? And how do these elements operate in the reverse direction during normal development? So this is a very intense field of studies.
Hello.
It's good to hold it. It gives people confidence.
You mentioned similar to the question that my friend had, which was induced pluripotency in similar cells like the insulin cells, the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans. We have used the genetics with genetic technology. We've developed a gene which is humulin, which is introduced into the beta cells. So instead, can we introduce new cells into already functioning beta cells?
Yeah. So the question is whether one can use differentiated cells and use them to proliferate and generate more and more cells. Most times this doesn't work. The differentiated cells usually do not proliferate. And many times in order to proliferate, I mean, one of the notions about what happens in normal beta cells is that in order to generate more cells, these cells have to, by a natural IPS process, have to go back to a non-differentiated state, proliferate, and then differentiate again. So, and the worry is also that by inducing artificially cell proliferation, I mean, we know how to do that. That's how we can make tumors in mice. That this will be a non-controlled proliferation and you will be generating a tumor. So this is a route that people are more reluctant to take.
When we are this cell-to-cell communication, what criteria exactly telling which direction this protein should follow? Mm-hmm. Is that anything? Yeah. Some criteria is there in this cell that it is following?
Yeah. So in most cases, there is actually no directionality. So in the first example I showed you, where one cell becomes a neural cell, it inhibits its neighbors symmetrically. In the case of morphogens, for example, actually, I mean, that morphogen that I showed, this, the picture was actually cut. It's actually in the center of the wing, and it patterns both sides symmetrically. But there are situations where, for example, there are two different compartments next to each other. One compartment makes the morphogen but does not respond to it. The other one can respond but doesn't make it. And in that case, you can see that the morphogen flows just from one side onto the other side and activates only one side. So there are variations, but in general, there is no directionality to the flow. The idea is that the pattern is evolving over time. So you start with a minimal asymmetry, like you define which cell will produce the morphogen. But other than that, everything else is naive around. If you had a direction, you would already have information embedded in the receiving cells, which is usually not the case. So the idea is to start with a minimal information and then gradually build specification and complexity. And usually the ligands are not directional in the way in which they spread out.
And is that when during communication, which the cell sending the protein is looking for any response from the other cell?
The question is whether the cells that send the signal, do they need a feedback from the receiving cell? Is that the,
yes? Yes.
Many times not, but there are instances where such feedbacks do operate. Sometimes we don't understand them. We've spent this afternoon talking for 2 hours about such a feedback between the sending and the receiving cells that we don't understand. So there are elaborations which can work in that way, but as a rule, you have the sending cell, it sends out a signal, and then the receiving cells take that information, they can buffer it, they can attenuate it, but usually there is no signaling back to the sending cell. Yeah. So I guess the notion of all these popular companies that pop up is that if we will inject young cells, well, I guess these cells will not come from us if we are aged, right? They have to come from a younger donor, but then it's a transfer between different donors and recipients, so that's a problem. I guess the idea is, I mean, if you want to take it from our own body to take cells which hopefully were protected from the effects of aging, and in a way stem cells are protected from such defects. I mean, you can think about a stem cell that divides all the time. If it accumulated mutations, the amount of mutations you would have would be enormous, and the cell division can induce accumulation of such mutations. So there are stem cells of the gut, for example, were shown to, even though they divide many, many times, to be resistant to accumulation of mutations. So if one can find such compartments within our own body where the cells are more protected from effects of aging, perhaps these cells could be utilized to make tissues. It's not clear to me which tissues you would want to make in order to prevent aging, but I guess, I mean, in the long future, that may be a possibility. Yes.
Excuse me. We know morphogen-dependent cell differentiation occurs in vivo, but if it is, can we mimic it in culture plate? If we grow stem cells in a culture plate in vitro condition?
Yeah. So the ability to mimic morphogens in vitro was done. I mean, so you can take cells in a culture and put either a high level or a low level of the morphogen and get different responses. I guess in the case of stem cells, I mean, if you would want to generate an organ or a mini organ, then you would have a source, and somehow this source will provide the distribution. So I think the notion is that it will be possible to generate different signaling levels and so on, yes. I think what's important for me to emphasize, I forgot to do it during the lecture, in the talk and in the book and so on, the application, I put the applications only at the very end. And it's important because this is how it happened historically. I mean, it's not like people were looking at the fruit fly because they wanted to find a solution to the human pancreas. They were looking at the fruit fly because they were curious about embryonic development in the fruit fly. Everything that emerged out of that is sort of a bonus, if you will, but it wasn't the original intention. So all of these findings, which have enormous implications for medicine, started from curiosity-driven research, from addressing very, very basic questions, which were not aimed at a medical application. And this is something very important to keep in mind. I mean, if we future solutions to different diseases and so on will not necessarily come from addressing exactly the disease that you want to cure. They will come from unexpected directions, and it's very important to maintain the breadth and diversity of scientific research in order to give room for these unexpected findings. And there is more and more tendency in current research funding and approaches to research to focus on the final disease that you want to cure, and in doing that we are missing so many things in biology, and most of the interesting findings in biology came from unexpected directions. So we cannot fool ourselves to think that we know where to look and that's where the solutions will be. We have to be much more flexible in that.
In a set of cells, say, which are not differentiated, and we have some differentiated cells, and those differentiated cells will send signals to the others to tell them what they have to do. Mm-hmm. But in an embryo, when there are absolutely no differentiated cells, and what is the stimulus for the very first differentiation to take place?
Right, so this is a very good question. Where does the first asymmetry come from? And this comes from an event that we call the symmetry breaking event, and I'll refer to the Spemann experiment that I showed in order to say what that is. So this is an event which has to be very definitive, and it breaks the symmetry. So in the case of the embryo of the frog, you have the egg sitting in the water, and it's all oriented in a way where what we call the animal pole is always up, and the sperm comes, and it can penetrate it at any point radially along the circumference. There is no pattern in the egg. The egg is completely symmetrical around its circumference. So randomly, the sperm will penetrate at one point, and the point where the sperm will penetrate generates changes within that cell, and exactly opposite to the place where the sperm penetrated is where what we call the Spemann organizer, the cluster of cells that will give rise to the head, is present. So there is a symmetry breaking event. It's very crude, it's very definitive, and this sets in motion now all these processes that we talked about. Now, contrary to the signaling pathways, which are conserved universally, the symmetry breaking events are events which are usually random, and they may be very different for very different species depending upon the biology of that species. So this axis is determined in the frog by the place where the sperm enters. The belly versus back axis in the fruit fly is determined by a random migration of the nucleus in the egg to one pole or the other. So these are usually random events, but they're very definitive, and once they happen, they set everything in motion. And because complexity is built in a hierarchical manner, once you carry out this first event in a decisive manner, everything else now will follow based on that.
slowly. Yes. Yeah.
On the pamper, that's...
Yes.